Continuing in mitzvah Shin Lamed Ches 338, the mitzvah not to distress any Jew verbally. The Noheges mitzvah zo b'chol makom v'chol zman. It applies in all places and all times. B'zachar munikevos. Certainly, there's no difference between males and females in this regard. It's a negative commandment. B'afilu b'ketanim roi li zayir shelolach ivan b'dvarim yoser midai. He says it seems to imply that the mitzvah does not technically apply to young children. But nevertheless, it's some sort of like midas chsidus, the nice practice that you should try even not to distress children. The Minchas Chinuch has a comment on this, and he says, what do you mean? Why shouldn't the mitzvah apply to children? It's not like a bar mitzvah. It has nothing to do with bar mitzvah in terms of the recipient. It's just any Jew, you're not allowed to distress them. The Minchas Chinuch doesn't like this. He thinks that the mitzvah does apply with children, but the Sefer HaChinuch himself seems to imply that the mitzvah doesn't really apply with children, but it's better to be careful not to distress children anyway.
All of these sort of, I would call them similar things, also apply to children.
Yeah, that's why Mitzvah doesn't understand. Yeah.
It's not a general distinction like that.
No. Zulasi b'mash etzrichin harbe kidei shiyichu musar. He says, but there's one big difference between children and an adult, which is that children need to be consistently rebuked if they do something wrong. I mean, again, there's Mitzvah tochacha, there's a rebuke at that also, but it's not the same intensive chinuch education that you're supposed to give to children. So in a sense that you might be saying things all the time that hurt their feelings. You know, I can't, I want this baseball card. It costs $10,000. You know, it's a rare baseball card. No, you can't have it. Ah, you hurt my feelings. Okay, I have to buy you the baseball card. No, it doesn't work like that. That they have to be taught the correct path in life. So therefore, you're going to have to hurt their feelings pretty consistently, but that's a productive hurting of feelings and not a gratuitous hurting of feelings. So you should even be careful not to distress your children and the other people who live in your house. And it's actually, he doesn't mention this explicitly, I believe, but the Gemara mentions explicitly ona regarding one's wife. That it says that if you distress your wife, then that's like the worst thing in the world. That's like even on a higher level of ona than any other people, and it says because she's so tied into you, and she's uses the phrase "dimasa mitsuya," that women are more likely to cry than men. So since their feelings, since your opinion of them is so important, and they get distressed more easily than men as a general rule, again, not across the board, but so then distressing one's wife is considered to be a particularly severe sin. Va'mikel bahem shelo litzaron binyanim eila. And if you are lenient upon them, so you shouldn't cause them distress, you shall find life and blessing and honor. So again, you get the impression that isn't really part of the Iker Mitzvah, but a nice thing that you should do in order to get this additional reward to refrain from causing ona to the people in the household who are younger than Bar and Bas Mitzvah. The wife is different. The wife is Ikar than Ona. If you violate this and you cause your fellow distress with words, and all these similar things to the examples that Chazal gave explicitly, that again, if they're a repentant sinner, so then you should not mention to them what they used to do. And if they are ill, and you shouldn't try to provide explanations for their suffering, but rather just to lend a listening ear. So if you do all these things that we mentioned before, any similar things that cause people distress, avar alav zeh, you violated this negative commandment. Aval ein lokin alav levi she'ein bo maisa. That this is a lav she'ein bo maisa, is a negative commandment that one violates without performing an actual action. So therefore, the principle is that such a thing is not subject to the penalty of Malkus. That words, again, words, you're speaking, that's your, in English we would call that an action, but in Halacha, merely speaking is not generally considered an action with a few exceptions.
I assume the Baal Tshuva, Kal Chomer for a ger, that would be a much stronger era than Yom.
Right, so for a Baal Tshuva, so you don't have the additional prohibition, the requirement, v'havtem es hagerim, v'ger lo silchatz v'lo silcha, v'lo ger lo sanu, the explicit mention of ona by a ger as well, and a requirement to love them. So then, you violate, in addition to the regular onah that applies to all Jews, you have an additional level of prohibition, which makes it even worse. Certainly, you have to be extra careful.
I mean, we're talking about somebody is a convert and they're obnoxious. You're not allowed to say you're being obnoxious. I mean, you're not being obnoxious, you dirty bear. You know, that's not, you know, qua gare that they're being
correct. Again, if it's constructive, you know, if the person is, again, the Sefer Chinuch is going to mention in a few minutes, you know, if somebody is really being terrible to you, that you don't have to, you don't have to just absorb it. You're allowed to fight back a little bit. But in general, the point is just that you have to be extra on guard when you talk to Gerim, so as not to cause them any sort of distress. Whereas, you know, again, they're Dargis. Again, yeah, you can. Sometimes, for constructive purposes, you are allowed to cause others distress, but you have to tread extra lightly when it comes to gear. Leulam lefi hadome. I'm sorry. Luchama malkios mi bli ritzua shel egel biyad ha'adon hametzavel ze yisbarach veisale. He says, yeah. So you don't receive the penalty of lashes. So you might think, oh, this prohibition of onah, you know, that's not as severe as eating pork. You know, if I eat pork, I'm going to get lashes. And if I speak onah, if I distress another Jew, so I'm not going to get lashes. Sefer Chinuch is telling you, well, just because you don't get physical lashes with a strap made of calf leather, which is how the Malkus of the Bezdin was performed, nevertheless, God has other straps with which to smite you if you violate this prohibition. So you shouldn't think you're getting off scot-free just because you're not getting Malkus. God will find another way to punish you for the violation of this mitzvah. V'ulam lefi adome, says the Sefer Chinuch, ein b'mashmashim bo Yisrael echad v'ischil v'yirshiel v'tzarech avira b'dvarim aroim shelo ya'aneyu ha'shomeya. This, the Sefer Chinuch says, he thinks it's pashit, even though I don't think this is explicit in the Chazal per se, but the Sefer Chinuch thinks that it's a simple extension of this mitzvah, that if somebody comes to you and he starts insulting you like crazy, you know, calling you horrible names, and is really just being terrible and obnoxious, so you don't. You might think that the requirement of onah means that you're not allowed to say anything that will cause the person distress. So he says, you know, this person is yelling at you and insulting you, so you can't. You might think that you couldn't respond. You know, get away from me! You are being horrible! How dare you say such things? Because that could hurt their feelings. So you can't be, it's unreasonable of the Torah to expect someone to be like a stone which has no one to overturn it. You just sit there and it's like you're still and sitting there stone-like the whole time. Somebody's calling you all these horrible names and you just smile and nod. It sort of sounds like you're agreeing with them that maybe these horrible names are coming to you, so you have to protest. Torah does not require one to be like, again, it uses the metaphor of a stone. You can't, it's unreasonable to expect someone to be silent when being cursed, just like when one is being blessed. The whole point is that we're supposed to distance ourselves from the character trait of causing others distress. So you're not supposed to start up. You're not supposed to start up with causing others distress, but it doesn't mean that you have to be silent if others are causing you distress. We shouldn't be the ones to begin with the cycle of onah. And then if everybody will refrain from starting the cycle, then there will be no onah. If somebody is such a wonderful, idol, one person, so then people are not, in general, going to be inclined to insult him. Zulasi ashotim hagimurim, unless they're really just stupid. Ve'im lasei slave al ashotim. We can't, people who are really just not mentally all there, we can't pay attention to what they do, and people. If somebody who's really mentally ill starts insulting you, then you're going to be less inclined to respond than somebody who's compos mentis and knows what he's saying. But nevertheless, if you find yourself in the situation where people are insulting you and degrading you, and it's really not a good day, Roy lechacham sheyashiv lo derech silsul and imos velo yichas harbe. Nevertheless, you should minimize your response. You should act in a dignified manner and a pleasant manner, and you shouldn't get overly angry. So it's also unrefined. No matter how much somebody is insulting you, you know, the sticks and stones will break my bones, the words will never hurt me. Okay, they might hurt you. That rhyme is not actually, you know, emotionally correct. But nevertheless, one has to keep perspective that these are just words, so you don't have to fight back in the same way that somebody attacks you with a, you know, a weapon or something, then you have to fight back with utter force in order to make sure that it's that you don't get physically hurt. But here, you should maintain your composure and you say, you know, I really don't like how you're speaking to me. This is not a correct manner to speak. I strongly protest. Okay, you know, maybe people don't necessarily keep themselves to that exact tone of voice. But the point is that you shouldn't allow yourself actually to get angry and too worked up, but rather the minimum protest necessary in order to feel that you are fighting back and pushing back against these improper things that are being said to you.
Now, if the context of this is a dispute over Torah, you know, matters, the Machlokes L'Shem Shemayim, I mean, some people seem to think that the license is given to, you know, to get upset and to say sharp words if, in fact, you're beating somebody over a matter of Torah, but is it anything else? Is that true, or is that...
Well, if you're attacking ideas,
yeah,
you can use sharp words, unless they really are. You wouldn't use that. You know, apikor is not a word that you should use lightly. But in the Milchamta Shel Torah, when two Torah scholars are debating a certain issue, so often they can get very sharp. But A, the two Torah scholars who are debating are hopefully on the level that they won't take it personally, and the word should be phrased in a manner that's clear that the person is not being attacked, but rather simply the idea.
I mean, you're not stupid. You're just saying some very stupid things. So that's okay. That's
right. You know, you have all these
scholars. I can get these distinctions, whereas regular people can't.
Well, I don't know. It happens in regular people also. Again, a lot off Sefer Chinuch, but I remember I watched Justice Ginsburg's eulogy for Justice Scalia. So she said, they were talking about how they were good friends, even though ideologically they strongly disagreed. So she quoted him as saying, you know, even though he had very, very sharp words sometimes against things she was saying in her opinions, but she quoted him as saying, you know, I attack ideas, not people. Some very good people have some very bad ideas. So that was that's the perspective that we have to keep when we have fights of between Torah scholars, and we have all these, you know, lishonis, you know, these turns of phrase that are used in tshuvas, you know, to lessen the blow. The mechilas kvod Torahso, with the forgiveness of your honor of your Torah, you know, nevertheless you're completely wrong. You know, or maybe you forgot to look in this Tosfos, and you know, you have all these ways to express it that lessens the blow. Unless, again, it's something when the two great Torah scholars were fighting, so that's one thing. But when you're fighting against religious breaches in the fence, then sharp words are necessary. That certainly doesn't apply with this mitzvah. No, when the issue is kvod shemayim, when the issue is the honor of heaven, that is at stake.
And then you have rhetorical things like the Rishonim, who obviously are using a different level of argument against each other than
what do you mean?
We would do today. I mean, all the horrible things the Rishonim say about each other, the Mepharshim and whatever. Mm-hmm. How can you possibly say this? How can you be so stupid? I can't believe that you think, you know, that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh. Or the Ravid on the Rambam, famously. Yeah, the Ravid on the Rambam. I guess he felt that...
I mean, it's not just the two of them, though.
Right, there are, yeah, it happens other times also, yeah. But the famous example is the Ravid on the Rambam, who... I guess he really felt... It was more than just arguing about ideas. It was that he was fundamentally opposed to the idea of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, that, you know, without citing any sources and whatever, he just learned up all the everything in Chazal, and he wrote a whole code of law just giving his final opinion. The Ravid said, no, that's not how we do things anymore. We give reasoned arguments and essays, and you don't have a code of law that presents itself as being super definitive, which is why the Ravid wanted to say in his comments, hey, you know, you thought, reader, careful, you thought he's presenting this definitive code of law, and you're just reading it and saying, wow, this is organized so wonderfully, and it presents everything so clearly. So Rav is pointing out, this is stupid, this is ridiculous, this can't be, this is against the Gemara. So that's why he was trying to undermine the reader's confidence in the Rambam, which was his goal. So again, if you have a specific goal in mind, which is l'chvod shamayim, then it's okay to use very sharp words.
Be more appropriate to do it by bringing examples or riyas or what it is that you are holding instead of berating that other person.
I mean, the Ravid also wrote Svarim where he discussed his own personal opinions, but his whole point in the Sefer was to critique the Rambam. His glosses on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah, his whole... The point was not to present systematically his own opinions, but rather to point out where he felt the Rambam made major errors.
Wouldn't it have been that process more correctly applied by bringing proof of sources? Why that?
He did in a very short manner. He didn't. These are not long essays, but the Ravid does definitely cite more sources than the Rambam. He says this is against the Gemara and such a Masechta, and this is against.
It's also the whole method, basically saying that this is not the way to discuss halacha. You don't say, right. Okay, this is in fact, period. This
right.
is when about giving any discussion or giving any sources, right?
Right. Right.
And but whether it's not maybe in any particular, even if he agreed with the Rambam, I assume he'd say this is not the way to learn Torah.
Right. That's what he writes in his comment on the introduction to the Mishnah Torah. But we assume that when he's writing his comments on the Mishnah Torah, so he generally just presents points of halacha in which he disagrees with the Rambam. Mm-hmm. It's all a question. Was he comprehensive with his comments? Did he cite every single place in the Mishnah Torah where he disagreed with the Rambam? So the question is, when you're counting up Rishonim who hold a certain way, so if there's a place in the Rambam where there's no comment of the Ravid, can you count two opinions? Can you assume that the Ravid agrees with the Rambam on that point or not? Which is not always so clear. There seem to be places in, he wrote Svarim, like the Balei HaNefesh, he wrote a Sefer on Hilchos Nida, so some of the places, some of the things he said in Balei HaNefesh contradict what the Rambam said in Hilchos Nida, and the Ravid didn't argue when he wrote in that place, so either he changed his mind, or he wasn't comprehensive with his comments on the Rambam. So the point is, you should try to present it in the way that's the most, that will get people, they will get your point across in the way you want to get it across, but without resorting to personal insults. And to a certain extent, when you publish a halachic sefer, so you're opening yourself up to criticism, and that's understood, that you can't expect. That if you really get overly angry, then that Koheleth says that anger lies in the breast of the fools. That only fools get really angry. And the Rambam famously says in Hilchos Deos that you're supposed to show anger when there's something appropriate, like when your family is doing something wrong and you need to tell them that it's really wrong. You're supposed to pretend to be angry, but in your heart, you're not supposed to feel anger. Okay, it's just to show to get them to comply with what you do. But if you really get angry when somebody insults you like this and you respond in an uncontrolled manner, then that is considered to be foolish. So you're supposed to just do something that saves you from being perceived in this negative manner, even though this fellow is calling you all sorts of bad things. And you should put the, like shame on you. You should basically, instead of displaying your terrible anger at being called all these names, you're supposed to turn the tide and basically make the person who's acting out at you look foolish. That they're saying all these things which are obviously wrong, and defend yourself and maintain your composure. That's an important lesson to learn in life. That sometimes, you think you're fighting back and you're going to win your points, and it doesn't actually work. I remember one time, so there used to be, I think they stopped this, thankfully, but there used to be a delegation from Crown Heights. They used to come every Thursday night to the YU based medrash to learn chassidus, you know, Chabad chassidus shesvarim with bacharim at YU. So at one point, one religious figure, you know, got into an argument with them, you know, because they thought it wasn't appropriate they were coming, which probably wasn't, but there was a way to react to it. And, you know, he started, you know, screaming at this guy, you know, this is why you know, this is not appropriate. You're taking people away from their learning. It's like proselytizing. And the Chabad fellow that he was talking with, he responded very calmly, you know, we ask permission and everything, you know, people enjoy it and they're learning. Responded very calmly. So they made the scene in the middle of the Beis Medrash. And unfortunately, the Bavitcher won. He maintained his composure, and everybody was at the end of the day. Everyone was sympathetic with him, instead of with the person who I intellectually had the correct argument, in my opinion. Okay. Zehu derech hatovim shebim ne'adam. This is the way of good people, the best of the human race. V'yish lanu lilmod davar zeh shemuter lanu lanos ksil. So how do I know this? It doesn't say in Chazal anywhere that you're explicit permission to respond to a foolish person who is insulting you. There's a din that if somebody is breaking into your house to steal things, then you're allowed to kill him. So the point is that you can't just... The Torah never requires you just to sit there and turn the other cheek.
Yes.
In a Christian terminology, to turn the other cheek. You're supposed to protect yourself. So from this idea that you know maybe this person who's coming into your dwelling, to your house to steal something is not intending to kill you, but nevertheless. A, maybe they are, but B, even if they're not, you can't just, the only way to protect yourself against your property being taken is by killing this person, then you're allowed to do so. So the same thing over here. So it's not worse than this. That if there are things that are lacking content and just are telling... telling people wrong things about you and just insulting about you, the whole davar shiyachol inatzlemenu. So you have to protect yourself. You're not expected to just sit there and allow yourself to be undergo this humiliation and insult and distress. The ulam yesh kasmi bnei adam. He says, oh, even though this is the way to go meikar adin, kasmi bnei adam sheola chasidusam kol kach. There are some people that are so pious. Again, a minority. I don't say this is for everyone. But there are some people who are so pious, shelo yirtzu lahachnis atzman be'orazu, lo shiv charfeim davar. They don't want to rely on this, that is not a problem of onos dvarim to respond to your detractors. They want to be nizar on the prohibition of onos dvarim in all situations. Pen yigbar aleim akasis pashtu be'inyan yosir midai. They're afraid that if they start with the fighting back against the insults, the anger won't just be displayed outwardly, it will really penetrate their hearts. They'll really succumb to the improper character trait of really getting worked up and angry. We know that the Gemara says, "Kol hakoeis kilo oved avodah zarah," because you get truly angry on the inside, then you lose control. The next thing you know, that if you get really angry, you might go worship avodah zarah, because you get into the habit of listening to your yetzer hara. So they don't want to get into the habit of listening to the Yetzer Hara. They want to be extra religious. V'aleihem amru zichronam livracha. Ha'ne'alovim ve'inam olvim. Chazal tell us that those who are insulted and don't insult in return, sholim cherpasam ve'inam meshivim, they hear people who attack them and embarrass them and they do not respond. Aleihem akosuv omer v'o'avav ketzeis ha'shemesh b'gvurasu. Those who love God are like the coming out of the sun in its strength. So this is, in Jewish tradition, this is a darga, perhaps, to aspire to, but is not something that's halachically required. And we know we daven for this every day in Elokai Netzor. It says in Elokai Netzor, V'lim kalalai nafshi tidom. May my soul be silent in the face of those who curse me. The idea is that we shouldn't get angry, we shouldn't take it personally, and we should say, you know, basically, nebuch for this person that they treat me in this manner, that it's so inappropriate, and they're such bad people that they treat me in this manner, that really I should pity them, as opposed to trying to fight back. So again, it would depend on the situation, it would depend on the person's personal spiritual level, but again, this is the way the Sefer Chinuch presents the dichotomy between the prohibition of Onas Dvarim, causing distress, and the permission to respond when one is insulted and attacked. Mitzvah Shin Lamed Tes 339. Shelo Nimkor Sade Be'eretz Yisrael Itzmisus. Back to agriculture, which is, not agriculture per se, but real estate. That you should not sell a field in Eretz Yisrael with a permanent sale. Shelo Nimkor Sade Be'eretz Yisrael Itzmisus. You can't sell a field in Eretz Yisrael forever. The land shall not be sold with a permanent sale. Kilomar is the Targum Onkelos translates lachlutin, which in modern Hebrew means absolutely. So it means lachlutin means without any conditions, without just an absolute sale that is designed to last forever.
We know from Yovel though.
This is related to the Yovel, yeah.
Okay, right.
Oh, you'll see how we're talking about how it relates to the Yovel. Exactly different opinions. Be'afal pisha Yovel mafkia be'al korcham. Hey, what do you mean? So if I sell you my field, and I say, hey, I'm selling you this field, you'll pay me a little more money, and I want to sell it to you forever. Forever. Okay, great, you know, I'll pay you more money, I'll get the field forever, why not? No, it doesn't work. Such a sale doesn't work, and the field will go back to the original owner and the yovel. You can't do that because against the Torah. The Rambam says that if you conduct such a sale, even though it's ineffective, you violate this prohibition. So I say, hey, buy my field forever. You say, yes, you pay me the money. Once you conduct that sale, even though it just doesn't work, the sale with the field will come back after the end of the Yovel year. Nevertheless, you receive the penalty of lashes, even though the sale is ineffective. Yeah?
Well, but there's no sale then. In other words,
even so, you go through the motions of a sale. That violates this prohibition. But you say like the Ramban. The Ramban zichron alvracha kasa shadivrei rabbezeh keinyan amuskar barishon shel tmura. It's reminiscent. The Ramban doesn't agree with this. He says that the way the Ramban presents this mitzvah is reminiscent of the discussion in the first parak of Maseches Tmura. Dama Rava hasam cholik alabaye. Rava says the chol milsa. We normally pass like Rava. The chol milsa the amar achmana lo saved. E avid lo mahani velaki, that everything that the Torah says, don't do it. If you do it, it's ineffective, yet you receive the penalty of lashes, and he disagrees with Abaye over there. The Abaye says it is effective to go against the Torah, and you wouldn't receive the penalty of lashes if it weren't effective. So Rava says it's not effective, and you still receive the penalty of lashes. Mishum da avar aharmana demalka. You showed that you wish to violate the decree of God, the decree of the king. So therefore, you receive the penalty of lashes, you violate the mitzvah, even though it's ineffective. So this discussion, of course, is in the context of tamura, that the tamura, as we'll see at the end of this parsha, the Torah says we're not allowed to exchange sacrificial animals. So you say, I'm exchanging this animal for this animal. This one's going to be, this one used to be designated as a korban, and this one's not designated as a korban. Now, whoops, I changed my mind. I wanted this one, I don't want holy anymore. I want this to be holy in its place. So the Torah says, so the whole discussion over there is, you know, how could you violate tamura if the Torah says there's no such thing as tamura? Mm-hmm. Because we know the Torah says, vayahu smura so yiyah kodesh, that if you do such a thing, then both the animal, the original one, and the second one. So you lost out twice, and the second one will be designated as sacrifices. So if that's the case, you basically didn't accomplish what you set out to do, which is switching them. It's impossible to accomplish that, because the Torah says you can't. So that's the discussion over there, that even though you just went through the motions of Temura, you showed that you wanted to do Temura, even though it doesn't work, you still receive the penalty of lashes. So the Rambam says that selling a field permanently is similar, because you're attempting to sell it permanently, it doesn't work, but nevertheless you receive the penalty of lashes. You never actually accomplished the prohibition, but going through the motions of the prohibitions is enough. But the Ramban says, "Vuzikron levracha perish binyan acher." He says that if that were true, that what the Rambam said, that you're not, that it's talking about selling a field and saying that it shouldn't return in the Jubilee year, and it just doesn't work, but you receive the penalty of lashes. So this should be given in the Gemara over there as an example of something that if you do it, even though it doesn't work, if you try to do it, you receive the penalty of lashes. But it's not mentioned the Gemara over there. So there must be a different explanation, and we must be here talking about something that does work. That there is, that you sold the field permanently, and the sale does take effect permanently, but nevertheless you receive the penalty of lashes because you are mafkia, the field coming back to the original owners in the Jubilee year. You prevent that from happening. So how does the Ramban say it's talking about? Shemazir osanu shelo natzmis haaretz biyad hagoyim. You're not allowed to sell the field to non-Jews. You should not give a permanent land sale to non-Jews. Because, will the non-Jew return it to you in the Jubilee year?
They don't have to.
They're not commanded in this. What do you mean? The Jubilee is, the Yovel is not shaykh to them. So what are you talking about? So only a non-Jew is going to take hold and possession of lands in Eretz Yisrael forever. But a Jew would have to return it. And the Yovel. But if you say to the goy that you have to give it back in a little while, after a certain number of years, then you are allowed to sell it to a non-Jew.
Isn't there a prohibition? You cannot sell land to non-Jew, Biklal, whoever it was, you know.
Excellent. So a lot of the commentators say, how does this make sense? How does Ramban make sense that this is talking about selling a field to that? So that's prohibited anyway. It says, lo sechonim. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to give them chanaya bakarka. You're not allowed to sell land in Eretz Yisrael to non-Jews at all. Okay, so people come up with different explanations. One of which is, if you sold for pikuach nefesh. If you're selling a parcel of land for Bikuach Nefesh, you mamish have no money, you have to go for medical treatments, and the only person available to buy your land is a non-Jew, then you should at least not sell it as a permanent sale. You can say give it a certain period of time, but you cannot sell it as a permanent sale. That's teres number one. Teres number two is that I was talking about a ger toshav, who's allowed to live in Eretz Yisrael. He is not Jewish, but he accepted the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, but he's allowed to live in Eretz Yisrael. So again, it's a little bit, it is a little bit difficult. But nevertheless, that's what the Ramban held.
There really is no such thing as a permanent sale. It's basically, it's like a long-term lease or something like that. A 49-year lease already, or something like that. That's right? It's not a,
Essentially, yeah. Yeah. I mean, as we'll see, that this mitzvah only applies to the ancestral lands. You know, if they're lands that you wish to buy, then you're allowed to, and you bought it of your own volition, then you are allowed to sell it permanently. Mishor shei mitzvahs hayovel, mashikosavdi, mitzvahs minyan shnei hayovel, rishonu b'shebeseder zeh, that it's connected to the reasoning for the mitzvah of Yovel, because, you know, you want the recognition that God is in charge of the world, and we are not the balabatim on the world to the extent that we can conduct permanent sales of land in contravention of the way God intended the land to be divided. Some suggested that the Ramban, by the way, was talking about any non-Jews, not Ovid Avodah Zarah. But this is not correct, because there's this misimpression that you're only not allowed to sell land in Eretz Yisrael to non-Jews who are Ovid Avodah Zarah is due to censorships. Because in the printed books, so in printing, when there are manuscripts that were copied surreptitiously and circulated in the Jewish community, so the non-Jews couldn't really keep their eye on the Jewish books. But once printing developed and there were these huge public printing houses, you know, and the books are much more widely available. So the non-Jews and the Jewish Mishumadim, who converted to Christianity, started to read Jewish books, and they found things in there they didn't like. So they changed it. So, and the Jews also used to self-censor their books so as not to offend the sensibilities of the Goyim, and they would potentially have a violent response. So one of the things that they changed is that anytime in it says the word Goy, Gentile, they used to change it to Akum, Ovid Kochavim Umazolos, as if to imply, you know, this is talking only about the, you know, the non-Jews in the olden days, the primitive ones. You know, these rules don't relate to our beloved Christian neighbors here in Europe. You know, never would we dream of such a thing. So there are certain halachas that only relate to non-Jews who actually worship Avodah Zarah, but a lot of halachos apply to any non-Jews. So this led certain people astray, but also regarding the Heter Mechira, that since in certain censored texts it says you're not allowed to sell the land of Israel to an Akum, to an Oved Kochavim Umazolos, so they thought that meant only a non-Jew who worships Avodah Zarah. So a Muslim, they said, you're allowed to sell land in Eretz Yisrael too, but it's not true. It's not true. It was led astray by the censorship. So that suggestion that the Lo Sechanim doesn't apply to non-Jews who don't worship Avodah Zarah is not an appropriate teretz for the Ramban's explanation of this mitzvah. Mishorshim mitzvah. Oh, sorry. Midinei haMitzvah, Masha Amar Zichron Lebracha, Shamocher Sadeu L'Shishim Shana Yoser, Kol Zman Sheyizkor Lo Sechum Shanim Eino Chozer Bayovel. So we have an interesting loophole for this, which is that if you mention a specific amount of time which is greater than the Yovel, the sale is effective. So I'm selling you my field for 100 years, 60 years, 40 years, and you were standing only for 30 years before the Yovel. So that sale is valid, and the Yovel will not cause the field to return to the original owner, because it's still not an absolute permanent sale. So the only things that return in the Yovel are something that are just sold without any conditions or explanations, or one that is sold permanently, which doesn't work again permanently, permanent sale. So both of them, going back with the Rambam's explanation, that both of them, both the buyer and the seller, violate the prohibition, and it doesn't work. Shein mastin lavor al divrei Torah. You can't have a tanai to violate the words of the Torah, which is a whole separate, lengthy discussion about when such a thing does work and when it doesn't work. Shatara amra v'aretz lo simacher litzmisus. That the Torah says that the land should not be sold permanently. Aval kolzman shemazkirin b'neim skum shanim ein zesmisus. If they mention a number of years, even if it subsumes the Yovel, then it's not a permanent sale and it would work. The Torah said that I'm imposing a cutoff point for all sales, which is the Yovel. But it doesn't say that. The Torah says it should not be sold permanently, which means that you could jump, you know, one or two Yovel cycles, but it can't be a permanent sale. The Bashwa the Cholzman unless you sell it, if you don't sell it permanently, then it does not go back in the Yovel. If you just sold it for 60 years, say. That if you make a condition that your purchase should not be nullified and the sale will not return to the original owner in the Jubilee year, that the Tanai, the condition is as if it's not there, and it will return in the Yovel. This doesn't apply to the cancellation of debts in the Shemitah year. So if you say, I'm lending you $50, but on the condition that you have to pay me back, even though it's going to be after the Shemitah year. Einu nishmat b'shvias, d'chol tanai shebemamon kayam. That the Shemitah will not cancel the debt, because any condition regarding money is in existence. V'nosan tam ladavar l'fi shebeshmita lo huzer al shmitas k'safim kim ha malveh. because it doesn't. It's not an across the board rule by the Shemitah that it applies only to the lender, as opposed to the Yovel, where the mitzvah is on both the buyer and the seller. That anyone who has lent out money and is going to collect money is not allowed to do it after the Shemitah year. But not the lender, the borrower. The borrower, if the borrower wants to pay back the debt after the Shemitah year, it just doesn't feel right, you know, emotionally. I borrowed money, I should pay it back. Maybe you should get more of a halachic mind. Okay, but in theory, there's no problem whatsoever with the borrower paying back the debt after the Shemitah year. So therefore, it's not considered a masna mashakosu b'Torah. It's not considered to be a tanai that goes against the Torah because it doesn't affect the mitzvah observance of the both the borrower and the lender. But by the Jubilee, both the buyer and the seller were commanded regarding this. It's regarding all of them. It says the land should not be sold permanently. You can't have a condition when you're discussing the terms of the sale. You can't say the sale goes forever. Because the ultimate owner of the land is God, and it's not within our capability to sell it absolutely. So it's not as if, you know, the lova. It's as if when you lend someone money and you say, but I'm making a condition that the Shemitah year should not cancel this debt. So in a sense, the lova could say, sure, you know, this is my this is your mitzvah, and it's my money that I'm choosing to pay back to you. So sure, I have the option of being mochel, of forgiving this. Of my what's it working really supposed to be in my advantage, that I don't have to pay back the money, so I can forgo that. But if you're dealing with a buyer and the seller, that it's not has nothing to do with monetary issues, it's just for God. So then you cannot, there's no mechila. It's not shayach to say that one says, oh no, it's okay, you can have it forever. And yeah, okay, I don't mind, I'll buy it forever. It's just not relevant to that. It's more than just a monetary transaction. Since God agreed, so the land is always going to go back to the original owner. Why would you think that making a condition more than once is any different? It's not going to go back in the Yovel. It's forever, it's forever, it's forever, it's forever, it's forever. You say that 1,000 times, so why should that help? Making it stronger, okay, somehow. So if you think you're making it stronger by doing that, it doesn't work. This is a good explanation. He switched to a little bit of a different topic right now, which is that if you sold your field, your steachuza, your ancestral field, and you have other fields that you bought later, and now you want to sell those and buy back your ancestral field. Because there is a rule that you can buy back your ancestral field at any time before the Yovel. You just have to deduct the amount of money of the sale that relates to the years until the Yovel. So he says the Mishnah says in Erchin that you're not supposed to sell property acquired in order to redeem your ancestral field. That you shall find money in order to redeem your ancestral field. You have to find new sources of finance that were not in your possession at the time where you sold the field. You're not supposed to borrow money and redeem the field with the borrowed money. Ain't show milo. You shouldn't. You never. Even though you think it's a good thing that he wants to redeem his field, shenemar v'siga yodo, that you shall have the financial prowess and capability below she yilva, not to borrow money. So what is this talking about? V'inyan sdos achuza. what these things that we're talking about are only ancestral fields. Yikaru asado shenaflu birusha lechol echad miYisrael v'chiluk haaretz. These are the ones that are when the land of Israel was first divided. That is those fields. V'chein mi shezocha benosvach uzasto machmas asibas nachala al yedei bas yoreshes nachala. There are, even if it wasn't part of your original chaluka, your original ancestral land in Eretz Yisrael, there is a time when you could, it could be transferred when there is a daughter who inherits property. Again, the famous story of Benos Tzlafcha, that they're only daughters, so they inherited their father's nachala. But they were supposed to marry, God told them that they're supposed to marry people from the father's family, from their father's family, because otherwise it would create a mess that their husbands would then inherit them, and they were there, and their sons would be from a different shevet, a different tribe, would get the nachala, which passed to the daughter, and then to her son, which who could be from a different tribe, because the tribe goes by the father. So that would be a whole mess. You'd have someone owning a patch, someone from Yehuda holding, you know, owning a patch of land in the middle of Shevet Dan. That this could happen in the future, that God told Benos Lavcha they had to marry people in their father's family because the original division of the land should be in accordance purely with the Shevet. But in the future, this could happen. This was not a prohibition that God was saying for eternity, that they that the pieces of land from each nachala should not go to a different nachala. Elu heina nikroin stos achuza. These are called the fields of achuza. But it's chadash dina b'torah mishar sados leinin hageula shesdei achuza nigal yedei mocher al yedei golo lachar shteishonim b'al korcho shelokiach. That after 2 years of a sale, the first 2 years of a sale, you have to let the purchaser settle into his land. You can't take it back right away. But after 2 years after you sold it, you have the right to purchase back your stei achuza and give back some of the purchase price. Ushar sados nikraim stei mikna, ones that you buy of your own accord, einam nigalim ela beratzon halokeach. So those are only redeemed, you can buy back only if the purchaser wants. Ela shiamdu biyad lokeach ad hayovel. But they stay until the yovel in the hand of the purchaser.
The Jewish National Fund is-